Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. It was Your Child's Brain, a 1996 Newsweek cover story connecting cognitive abilities and music in the developing minds of children that dramatically impacted the career of my guest today. A music teacher since 1980, Leisha Lecarey was more than intrigued by the article, spoke to scientists and researchers, and then challenged herself to translate the work being done in the lab into the classroom. Thanks to funding from various foundations, Leisha created her own program. She designed all the material, wrote piano books and teacher manuals, produced and directed CD recordings and videos, and in 1997, Music and the Brain was born. Since then, it's been used in more than 200 public schools in New York City, as well as schools in Long Island, New York, Newark, New Jersey, New Orleans, Ferguson, Missouri, Chicago, Philly, and internationally as well, Santiago, Chile, Paris, Afula, Israel. Hundreds of thousands of children, mostly ages 5 to 8, have learned to understand, appreciate the language of music, read music, and play piano, thanks to this music teacher on a mission. Leisha has a BA in education and music theory and a master's in music education from the Manhattan School of Music. She also spent 3 years studying with Nadia Boulanger, the French composer, conductor, and teacher credited with having taught many of the leading 20th century composers. Boulanger was also the first woman to conduct the Royal Philharmonic and the Boston and New York Philharmonic Orchestras. Leisha, welcome and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Sandy.
So let's start at the beginning. Were you always musically inclined?
I was musically inclined, but not profoundly talented. My teachers in my early years in school were not my inspiration. That came along a little bit later.
But did your parents encourage you to take up piano? Did you want to do that?
Oh, yes. My sister and I both studied piano, and I had two passions when I was younger. It was Bach and also Aretha Franklin. So I floated both ways in my musical tastes.
I read that your last year in high school, that you realized it was then that you wanted to be a music teacher?
Yeah.
Because?
Primarily because I studied with Boulanger during that last year.
So you were that young.
I went when I was a teenager.
How did that happen? How was that match made?
Well, I went to a hippie boarding school for the last years of high school, and we were allowed to do semesters abroad. So I went thinking that I would just increase my French and
go to Paris and hang out?
And maybe take piano lessons, because I had become interested in music at this boarding school as well. I just called her. And what's interesting about studying with her, one, it made me realize I wanted to teach because I didn't want to make students as miserable as I often was sitting next to her. At the same time, she taught me to listen to the inner voices and dig deeper and really hear what I thought I was listening to, which changed my life and which I still try to articulate to myself and to other people.
But what a contrast that must have been, sitting at the feet of greatness on some level and being, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but terrified?
No, not terrified. I left in tears. And the housekeeper would go, oh, ma pauvre. But towards the end of the time there, we had bonded. I started to get it. I just wasn't qualified to sit next to her for the first two, and not really the third, but we came to understand each other.
But wait, hold on. I mean, I'm assuming, I don't know Nadia personally, but I would have to assume that she doesn't suffer fools gladly. So she's just not going to take anybody and teach them piano. You had to have some form of...
She didn't teach me piano. She taught me composition and theory and counterpoint and all the components of music. I played for her sometimes, probably to her horror, because she had wonderful musicians sitting next to her. I was 17, and I really wasn't that great. I'm still not. But
where did you come off in your own head to say, I'm going to call her up? What made you do that?
Because it never hurts to try. I'm an optimist. You always try for things. If you don't get it, you don't get it. You move on. But you always try. I feel that way now. I feel that there's nothing one can't do. You just have to...
Well, that's pretty apparent by what was said in the introduction. But I'm just a little intrigued by not so much your chutzpah, but the fact that maybe your sense of self at such a young age. Is that fair?
It's fair, and I wish I could say more about it. I wish I could remember it all clearly. All I can say is that I came out of a fog that I started in with her, I started to understand about those inner voices. I started to get it. And it wasn't so deep, but really, I can't tell you why she took me when she first took me. I can tell you we grew closer. Something clicked with me, and then she tolerated me more easily towards the end.
But you stayed?
About 3 years.
For 3 years.
Yeah.
And then you came back home and decided you wanted to apply to the Manhattan School of Music.
Yeah.
Not that you were going to be another Nadia, but that was what you felt, that your calling would be in terms of teaching music?
I did. I studied composition and theory at Manhattan as an undergrad, but after that I went back and got my master's in music ed. It's just something I like to do. It's a passion. I'm not a performer, or at least I always told myself I was not a performer. You know, conducting is fun, and I did choruses and conducted in various jobs. And I thought I really wasn't made to be a performer. But what I've come to understand about teaching is that it is a performance art, and it's a thrill, and it's much more demanding as a performer. My hats are off to my teachers, because if you're a performer, you do a show, you get ready for it, you do it, it's over. The audience claps and you're done.
Right.
But teachers do it all day, every day, for years, and they have to be on to be good. You have to be on to be good.
Well, that's true of any subject that you're teaching.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, yeah.
You can't phone that in.
There's no coffee on the table. You don't sit around all day. You plan your lessons, mm-hmm. or they will chew you up and spit you out.
Right.
So it's really fun to teach when you get your energy back in your face tenfold. And that's what's happened to me as a teacher all my life. I never had a day I didn't want to go to work, ever.
So you taught in New York City at Hunter College High School and the Harlem School of the Arts.
Yes.
Contrast what that was like early in your career and music and arts programs back in the day, in the 80s, as to what is going on now.
It's depressing. I would date it back probably to the 70s. My guess is that homeroom teachers back in the day all had pianos in their classrooms, and children were given music classes in schools back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
I also think American schools were probably much more highly rated back in those days. My conclusion is music, but it's a whole bunch of things that's made our education system go down. But it's hard to compare what I do now because I'm working with elementary school children mostly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I had the privilege of working with high school. And at the Harlem School of the Arts, it was students who chose to be there after school and on the weekends. So I've been really lucky. Mm-hmm. to have landed really good schools to work in. So it's hard to compare now, but what I will tell you, what I'm seeing now in our classrooms, children are coming to school unable to read, unable to spell their names. They don't know how to look somebody in the eye and ask a question. And I don't blame parents, but it's really hard these days. They a lot of our kids go home to empty houses, and their parents are working three jobs to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not sitting down and talking to them. They're digging into a computer game or watching television. In fact, I would guess it's more computer nowadays. That's one of the biggest changes as well, what's happening at home as well as what's happening in schools.
There's just this lack of cultivating, you know, that side of the brain. What is it, the right side? I don't even, you know.
It's all over the brain.
It's all the brain, yes. Again, if you look back then and you look to today, the change has to be really
something.
Yeah.
Well, I will tell you, in New York State, elementary school music is not mandated. So some schools have it, some schools don't. And it's great that they have bands in middle school and high school and all of that, but the brain is forming with the youngest children. And mm-hmm. so grabbing them with a rigorous music program when they're young is where it's at. It does its work.
It's like, a no-brainer.
It's a no-brainer, thank you. It's like any language you want to learn, they teach it in high school.
High school, I know.
It makes zero sense.
Uh-huh.
So we try to get them fluent really, really young. That's what we're doing. But I'll tell you, where we're not doing it, a lot of schools simply don't have programs. They just don't offer music. Homeroom teachers, my daughter went to one of the great public schools in New York, never sang a song in a homeroom class with a teacher. I can't explain that to you. They just didn't do it. They played with crayons and did art, but they never got into music. And it's so easy.
What did it mean back then to be a music teacher? Because that wasn't necessarily extracurricularly. You taught...
Well, at Hunter, it's an extraordinary high school, first of all. But I was one of four full-time teachers there. And the kids that we got, I think I saw them four times a day for a semester.
Holy cow.
It was rigorous. It went on their report card. And, you know, those children at Hunter want to go into the colleges of their choice. They worked.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked them, and it was
Was it passion for them also, in addition to talent? And...
Some, yes. Mm-hmm. Others, no. A few were trained musicians. We had regular music and advanced music. And was it a passion? It became a passion for some of them. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm still in touch with some of them.
I mean, I'm personalizing this because I took up the trumpet when I was in elementary school. I didn't have any talent, and quite frankly, I was encouraged not to practice.
Well, I'm over this talent thing. It's not about talent. It's about loving the music, being turned onto it. So when you go to a school like Hunter and you see all these kids who are just, even in high school, they're sponges. They want to learn. You just go in and fill them up with it. It's just exciting. It was really, really fun. I had a student once at Hunter say to me, Leisha, what was the influence of jazz on World War II? And what was World War II influence on jazz? And I was looking at this child and I was thinking, we're going to talk about this tomorrow because I've never really stopped to think about it.
Isn't that great?
But it was things like that. It makes you love teaching. There's no way not to.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is music teacher Leisha Lacari, who also is the creator, founder of Music and the Brain. Let's go back to 1996 and that Newsweek article that apparently really spoke to you. Why?
We've all heard the expression, you use it or lose it.
Sure.
It became clear through that article. It was the idea of attacking it at a really young age, which you never really think about. People start piano later, it's private. And also trying to roll it out into the world of kids who are not going to get music lessons. So in that article, they mentioned Gordon Shaw and Franny Rauscher, who were working on something that at the time was famous called the Mozart Effect Study. And I went out to California to visit them, find out what they were doing. They had set up one of those lovely little science experiments where there's one teacher and three children. This is not the real world of teaching. And I went to see them and see what they were. They were looking for the connection between math and music specifically. Scientists do that. They don't like to spread it out too thin. But anyway, I saw what they were doing, and my thought was, well, this is great, three kids at a time. But what about classes with 30? How do we do this? Mm. And I came back to look at it that way. It also happened, this is sort of not connected to anything you specifically asked, but I had left Hunter in 96. My daughter was born that year. Mm-hmm. So it was a confluence of things. They had raised the number of teachers to 5. They brought it back to 4, and I was out. But it gave me time to think differently about teaching. And I never really thought about youngest kids.
The but stars Shaw, were sort of aligned in a sense. And maybe that was supposed to happen. You were supposed
I think
to
so.
Read
I
that
think
article.
So. And I did use my daughter as a guinea pig, but for the next 4 years. Shaw went on to do more work with math and sort of left music behind. Franny, who was a cellist and actually went to Manhattan School of Music, her mom was actually one of my mentors when I was there.
It was supposed to happen.
We don't need 6 degrees. But she continued to look at music's effect on the brain, and she looked at things with rats and things in labs, and she continued on to psychology, but she kind of maintained an interest in it.
So this speaks to you, and you take this article home with you, or let's put it this way, if you just can't shake the article, and at some point you felt that you had to take the next step.
Yeah, that's fair.
That's
the simplest way to put it. It was more complicated than that, but that's the simplest way to put it. And I think the best way to understand it.
Did you share that with anybody else?
Oh, yeah. What I was going to say is if we could just go back a little bit farther.
By all means.
My father was very involved in this, in the creation of this too, in a way, because though I had always been a music teacher, I think he wanted me to be something else. I don't know. Mm-hmm, but he finally came up to me one day and he actually showed me the article. So he said, music is really important. Music education is really important. And I said,
Yeah. I agree.
It is. So he was really a big part of the seed of this and looking at it in a bigger way than just my teaching. Although I'm not going to lie and say that I wouldn't have happily lived my life out in a high school called Hunter, if things had been different.
Mm-hmm.
But he was very much involved in the seed of this and bringing it to my attention and helping to grow it.
And so then
we piloted it. Yeah, we put together a team of people to look at the possibility of attacking it here in New York. And when we started, I was really just going to help them design it because of the people we brought together. He and I,
your dad and you.
Yep, there were no musicians, no music teachers. And it was going to be more a business model, I suppose. I don't know. I can't put words in their mouths. Mm-hmm. And a research project.
But then it took on a life of its own?
Well, it did. And it took a couple of years. It took spending hundreds of thousands on research, which luckily we got a grant for me to understand that the research is fine, but I don't need the proof. And the powers that be aren't going to look at the proof and change what they do in schools, which was probably my interest in research, was that, oh, we'll prove that this has this effect. We'll show math scores up. We'll show attention. We'll show literacy rates changing. And then schools, of course, they'll see it and they'll want to put it into every public school. This is simply not the case. I don't want to get really crazy on my feeling about the politics of New York City schools, but some schools are handled with care and some are not. And I wonder sometimes what the powers that be care about. So this was designed, and then how to get it into the hands of a teacher who could teach 35-year-olds at the same time. I've been a music teacher, but I never tried to put 5-year-olds at keyboards.
But was it basically, you read the article in 96, and then you give birth
to this
in
90? Yeah, we started piloting in 97.
Yeah.
And we initially worked with Teachers College, a wonderful teacher.
That's Columbia.
It is Columbia. And
University.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We worked with them in that we got one or two of their teachers to be the teachers for the pilot, and I would bring in music every day. I would sit, I would watch, I would observe, this song works, this doesn't work. How do we get rhythm into them? How do we start singing? What do we need? And Teachers College wound up going in a different direction than we did. But one thing kept leading to another. And then we found a school to pilot in, found the most amazing teacher. I have to nod Robin Casey at Midtown West. She's still there. She's the godmother of all of this, the goddess of it. And every year from that year on, up until this year, the materials have continued to be improved, tweaked. Some have been dumped, some of them been brought in based on what I've seen happening in the classroom. So we didn't have CDs when we started. We didn't have DVD videos of people playing it. We had to really see it in action to see what teachers would need to make it work well.
Was there a good reception?
There was a great reception. It was my learning curve that was perhaps slowed it down. When we started, for example, I thought every child had to have their own piano, that they needed chairs. I came to find out chairs are the kiss of death in a classroom with 5-year-olds. You have to have them standing. Mm. Now we're looking at a model where they share. So it's grown. It's improved. I feel like time will continue to improve it if I'm allowed to continue doing this.
Why the focus on 5 to 8-year-olds?
Because they have more neurons floating around that want to connect, uh-huh. that want to hook into this language. And where you can have a 5-year-old who can't spell their name, they can't read necessarily, although they should be able to.
Can they focus?
They can read music.
Wow.
They can focus. We're doing this in Paris with 3 to 5-year-olds who have completed my book 3 and have asked me to write a book 4 and a book of duets for them. These are in 3 bilingual Montessori schools. And we don't even have a music teacher there. It's the homeroom teacher that does it with them. The results are, I can't even describe it to you how profound it is. What we didn't know, and I didn't know, and I don't think the world knew, was how capable the youngest children are of doing this. Everybody thinks, oh, can they focus? Oh, can they behave? How are they going to understand this? It's too much to ask. Wrong. Wrong. They get it. They don't always articulate an answer the way you want them to, but often they'll go deeper on their answer to something you hadn't thought of as a teacher. I can't tell you how many times I've been schooled by the 5-year-olds that I go to visit. So it's just that nobody knew. Nobody knew how brilliant they could be.
So you start in one school, and then the next, you know, that commercial, and so on, and so on, and so on. Is that, in a sense?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure it was much more complicated than that.
Well, it was like that. We did a second one in Manhattan. Texaco came along and gave us a grant that focused us down in New Orleans, and we spread out slowly. And then one year, Sharon Dunn, who is the head of, I believe, music at the Department of Ed, Board of Ed back then.
Mm-hmm. In New York City, you mean?
In New York City. Uh-huh. She got in touch with us and said, I just was given a gift of, I can't remember the exact number, let's say 200 keyboards. Do you think you could use them? So suddenly I had all these instruments to give out, and we started soliciting a few schools to find out if they would be interested in doing it.
Now, did you do this during the course of the school day or after school?
I'm very glad you asked that. This is not an after school program. This is not an elective. It is required to be part of the curriculum.
Ah.
It has to be scheduled. So in a way, though we give it all, the school is doing a lot. They have to pay for the teacher. They have mm-hmm. to provide and pay for the teacher. Mm-hmm. And the scheduling can be a nightmare. Some of the schools have 1,500 to 2,000 kids in them. How do you schedule focusing on the Ks? It's been a challenge for us. It really has. Some schools answer the challenge by hiring a second music teacher.
But you're only a very specific age group. You're doing kindergarten, first, and second graders, basically.
That's what we ask for. We now require half of the teacher's schedule to be devoted to it so that they can also do older grades or chorus or other things they want to do. Where it works best, as it did with Pat Little pre-Katrina. She's
a teacher in New Orleans.
Bethune was a smaller elementary school back then, and she saw every child K to 5, maybe even pre-K to 5, every single day. So even watching what happened with her helped me to helped inform me on what to expect from our schools up here. But yeah, it grew slowly, little by little. You know, if you give out 5 to 10 grants a year, you get to several hundred after all these years. A year ago, we had a burst when we went to Ferguson. It was in response to what had happened. And we called them. We said, we'd like to give this to every school in that town. And so we rolled out big that year. But normally, we only can give maybe 10, 15, 20 grants out a year. So you do it very gradually. We've never advertised. We've called schools once in a while.
It's all word of mouth.
It's all word of mouth, but it's worked so well. And I must say, everybody wants it to roll out, and that's great. I do too. But the heart of me is glad it took this long, because what we've done with the materials is so improved. What we know about training teachers, we used to train them for a day. It's now 2. I may bump it up to 3 because our training is, I don't want to sound full of myself, but it's brilliant.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
Materials without training is useless. So
it's not a gut thing exclusively.
No, it's the books are great. The CDs are great. The rhythm cards make you drool if you're a musician. They're the best you can imagine. But unless you show people methods of using them. And we don't, our program's not scripted, but we show people a lot of ways that they can approach the materials. We've been informed ourselves. We've worked with, I think, something close to 280 teachers at this point. So we learn from them and we improve because of them.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is music teacher Leisha Lacari, who also is the creator, founder of Music and the Brain. Is the program found more in urban areas?
I want to focus on urban. Yes, absolutely. We have occasional country spots.
Or suburbs.
We are in suburbs, but I am interested in inner city schools. I'm interested in certain neighborhoods. I'm extremely interested in serving the African-American communities in all the cities that we're in. They're the least served by the Department of Ed, as far as I'm concerned. We try to find the neediest schools.
So you don't go to private schools?
They have to buy it.
They have to buy it. And a public school, whether it's New Orleans or Ferguson, is getting...
We give them everything, including the training. But again, I have to emphasize this. The school is paying for the teacher. That is huge. There's a few other programs going around where they provide a teacher and charge the school and do a whole different, you know, it's a different...
Dynamic.
A different model. Mm-hmm. But they have to do that. So it's not like we're the be-all and end-all. We give a grant. It's a limited amount of money. It's surprisingly affordable. As we move forward, and I think because of the attention from the CBS Sunday Morning Show, we've got calls from all over the country of schools that want to do this. There's no way we can service all of them, but we're looking at developing a model where they can purchase it and how we can help them keep the cost down. But it's really not that expensive. It's within reach. It's really within reach.
Talk about some of the kids in terms of success stories. That's where I first heard about this. You were featured on CBS Sunday Morning, and the reporter asked this little girl who her favorite composer was, and she, you know, I mean, she didn't say Elmo, which she could have said. She said Vivaldi.
She said Vivaldi and Beethoven, and then they said, well, why do you like Vivaldi? He wrote nice songs.
I mean, how could you not be so touched and moved by that?
It's very hard for me to visit any schools and not get pangs.
I'd be an emotional wreck.
I don't talk about the students as much as I talk about the teachers, because for me, all of them are worthy, brilliant, amazing. One of the songs in the curriculum is this Japanese folk song, Kuma-san, which is about a bear. It's like teddy bear, turn around. And we always teach the dance and it's so cool. We do Japanese and we think we're all that because we do all this, right? And they're playing it and they're clapping it and they're dancing it and they've learned a foreign language. But at the end, the lyric is sayonara, which means goodbye. And then we talk about language and, you know, all of that. But it's mostly about the joy of singing about teddy bears. So I was visiting one class one day years ago, and this little boy raised his hand. Unfortunately, it was the end of class because you could do a whole unit on this question. But he said, but why are we saying goodbye to Mr. Bear? And I thought, whoa.
Yeah, really?
This is deep. Well, no, oi or ooh or ah. And but it was an interesting question.
Uh-huh.
By the way, that question made it to the teacher's manual because he was traveling in his mind to places that none of us had imagined. And now all I can say is it's in the teacher's manual, but every single time I come away, either from visiting a school or doing a training with teachers, I think, oh gosh, I can't write this teacher's manual again. It's already 400 pages. How much can I put in it? And what's so exciting to me about it is that it's infinite what you can do as a teacher. It's infinite what you can think as a student. And they're expressing themselves. So part of our, I don't want to call it a methodology, but we want the kids to use their brains. And we really encourage teachers to ask questions rather than lecture. And I don't know if I ever go to visit a school without somebody, some little munchkin, saying something that I had never thought of before. You know, and I'm the one who wrote it.
Child is the father of the man. You know,
well, there's no question that these kids are proving it over and over again. And even the kids who act out, I'm not going to pretend that all these kids are
okay,
little.
Sure.
It's real. I want to keep it real.
Yeah.
You know, we're here in New York City public schools. It's real. You know, we had one child rolling on the floor one day, totally
disinterested.
I had brought a video crew who were maybe going to film them. And I went to Robin and, you know, she was teaching a wonderful lesson of the William Tell Overture at the end of book one. And she was asking the right questions, and she pointed to a line, the da-da-dum, ba-da-dum, ba-da-dum, ba-ba, right? And it comes in at the end again. She said, well, where have we seen this before? The answer she wanted was Two Systems Up. But there's this little kid in the back rolling and singing Old MacDonald Had a Farm, which was a song earlier in the book. And I'm sitting there thinking, I have a degree in music. You know, what? Why are you acting like this? I have a film crew here.
Yeah.
Robin, please do something about this child. Like, can I take him out of here? This is where mine was going. And he just kept going. And then he got somebody else, and they're like rolling and singing Old MacDonald in the midst of this William Tell Overture lesson. So it was an unfortunate thing. Side story, they did not film this class. But anyway, I went home and I thought about it. And I was like, why was he going on about this? With a moo-moo here and a da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. The rhythm.
Spoke to him.
It was the exact same rhythm, but juxtaposed differently in the measure. So none of us, with all our degrees in music.
Oh, that just gave me chills.
It gave me chills. Somebody else once compared our version of Largo to Jingle Bells, which I hadn't thought of. Now they're next to each other in the book because this child noticed months apart from each other, he remembered one rhythm and saw this and noticed that they were the same. And then they say adorable things too. I work with two other women in the program, and one of them is an amazing singer. She's featured on our CDs, and honestly, her voice will melt you. But they'll say things to her like, you're not bad at all. she's bigger in my mind. She's bigger than Beyonce because she's singing on the CDs, and then she'll appear visiting the class. You know, I get to go in and be the composer who's not dead because they've been told about the other composers. And by the way, I have not written many songs in the book. Whatever I wrote myself was to address a concept in music that I couldn't find a better song to use. So,
well, here's the problem. We've run out of time, which just blows my mind. But I would like to leave our listeners with a sample of Music in the Brain. Would you provide the introduction?
This is Pentatonic Waves. There's two versions, the one they play on the piano and the version we call our listening collection, which is the same song done up by a wonderful quartet of musicians. We do this to enhance their enjoyment of the song, and it takes it to a whole nother galaxy.
So we're going to take you all to a whole other galaxy. Thank you so much. I so enjoyed having a conversation with you.
Thank you.
And the wonderful work you and your team do.
Thank you
just very much. Inspiring. And I expect to see and hear from some of these 5 and 8 year olds.
You will. You definitely will.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.